I'm Manila Chan. You're tuned into Modus Operandi. As the Ukraine conflict enters its third year with no off-ramp in sight, many in the West are noticing mixed signals from their respective governments about how this regional war may soon impact them at home. From doomsday prepping to patriotic calls to join the military, we'll explore some of the not-so-subtle messages coming from Europe. All right, let's get into the MO. The WHO has issued a disturbing warning to countries in Europe. Start stockpiling medicines for nuclear emergencies. That message rang in 2023. And now, by 2024, the message is about stockpiling everything you can at home. Basic medicines, medical supplies, shelf-stable food, water, batteries, even candles. And when you read stories about celebrities and elites like Mark Zuckerberg allegedly building some sort of doomsday or nuclear fallout bunker in Hawaii, you really start to wonder if perhaps they know something we don't. Is there a cause for concern that expansion of the Ukraine war is possible? And just who would drive that expansion? For more on this, we'll bring in a geopolitical expert. Glenn Diesen, professor of political science and history at the University of Oslo in Norway. His newest book is out now called The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
So I am seeing a lot of TV commercials, magazine inserts, billboards, social media posts, articles from all over places across Europe, basically telling people to stock up on medicine because of forthcoming shortages, you know, just in case. Stock up on shelf-stable food, stock up on water, be prepared, they say. In case of what, Professor? I mean, for me, when I hear this, I think of toilet paper because, you know, the great TP shortage of 2020, that was due to COVID, but I don't get the sense that they're implying another pandemic will befall Europe. What are they really saying here?
Well, there's some contradictory message because on one hand, we hear from many officials that there's no direct threats from Russia. Russia wouldn't dare to attack NATO. On the other hand, we're also being told we have to prepare for war and Russia could attack. But this is part of the, you know, conflicting messages we get all the time. And but I guess this heightening the fear of war has some purposes. For one, it creates more incentives or willingness to invest more into the Ukrainian war. The assumption being that if we can fight Russia over there, then we don't have to fight them here. But it could also be a warning for possible future NATO involvement. Again, this would be a speculation, but obviously the war isn't going as we planned. And as if the Ukrainian army begins to collapse, NATO will have a dilemma at its hand. Is it going to watch Ukraine collapse and accept that this proxy war has been a failure and a defeat? Or will NATO then escalate by sending more long-range missiles, weapons, or sending actual more NATO troops into Ukraine, either officially or under the Ukrainian flag, both of which could then spark a direct war between NATO and Russia? So it's unclear if it's just to increase the support for the current war or planning for the situation to get more moving more towards a direct war. So, but again, it's a very strange one because no one's thinking that Russia will invade. No one has clearly said exactly what would be the point of this or the strategy.
Now, here in the States, we constantly hear mainstream media saying Putin will just march into the EU after the fall of Ukraine, you know, despite his constant rejection and denial of this notion and despite zero evidence to support this claim that are being made by politicians here in the U.S. and in Europe. Americans are split on whether or not to believe this. What about Europeans? Are they believing this allegation?
Well, I think they're also a bit split. Part of it is because the narrative is not consistent, because we keep saying that it's important to get Ukraine into NATO because Russia would never dare to attack Ukraine if it was part of NATO. On the other hand, we're also told that once Russia's done with Ukraine, it's going to march into NATO. None of this really makes any sense. You can't have it both ways. If we had proper journalists with integrity, they would ask this question, which one is it? But unfortunately, no one's really putting forward a clear narrative. The common denominator would be that we're being told, we should fear Russia, but still we are more powerful. So it ends up not being consistent. And this is something we've seen with over the past 200 years. Whenever there's a reference to Russia, it tends to take one out of two views. Either it's hopelessly backwards or it's an overwhelming threat to civilization. And we see this in Ukraine as well. The Russians are stealing toilets and washing machines to harvest them for computer chips. But at the same time, they're developing a doomsday device in space. They can't take a single village, we say, in Ukraine, but still they will roll all over Europe unless something is done. So it's I think it's the divisions in the country can be considered a product of this a very inconsistent narrative. So but again, this is the narrative we have. People are confused because they said Russia invaded Ukraine, that this invasion was unprovoked. If it was unprovoked, Russia is simply looking for a new territory. And if that's the case, it's in a form of opportunism. So it's very unpredictable where it will go next. But of course, if you admit it wasn't provoked, then you have to address other questions. To what extent did we help to provoke it? And then you would actually have to deal with the idea that there's a peaceful settlement to this, which we're not quite ready to do yet. So we're still sticking with the unprovoked narrative, which I guess fuels a lot of this confusion.
Yeah, let's also not forget Jens Stoltenberg publicly said the reason for the Russian invasion was the expansion of NATO into Ukraine.
Okay, can I add one thing on this? But this is part of the inconsistent narrative, because for years the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said, listen, NATO expansion had nothing to do with this war. This is just Russia wanting to restore the Soviet Union. Then, when he's on a different topic, he's talking about expanding NATO to Sweden and Finland. Now, he takes his victory lap and says, listen, the Russians told us they put a condition. Unless we accept neutrality for Ukraine, they would invade, because this was the main concern for the Russians. No more NATO expansion or we'll invade Ukraine. And he says, well, of course we said no, and Russia invaded. And now, and at the same time, then he's saying, listen, the Russians wanted less NATO on their border. Now they're getting more. So this was kind of the victory lap. But now he's been saying two things. This has nothing to do with NATO, and this is the reason why Russia invaded. So again, these two things can't both be true. So ideally, this is when a journalist would come out and say, well, which one is it? Because you've been saying two contradictory things, but he hasn't been asked that question yet.
So this fear-mongering over Russia, the constant comparison between Putin and Hitler or Russia and the Nazis, obviously World War II strikes a different nerve in Europeans than it does for Americans because, unlike the U.S., Europe really was getting taken over by the Nazis. But it was the Russians and the Soviets who staved off the Nazis. It was the Soviets who planted their flag on the Reichstag. While most Americans may not actually know this fact of history, Europeans should know. I mean, you're a university professor. Have the younger Europeans forgotten about their own modern history?
Well, it should also strike a different nerve for Europeans, because this would be the ground zero, or this was the center of the Second World War, and it would likely be the center of another world war if we would fight one against Russia. But also we should have a better memory of history, given that this was more on our soil, not in the United States. There's actually interesting polls which have been done in France since the end of World War II, when they asked this respondent of who contributed the most to the defeat of Hitler. Now, after World War II, you have almost 60% confirming, well, obviously this was the Soviets. And then you see decade by decade it's dropping. And I think now we're down to 14% recognizing it was the Soviet Union, which is quite astonishing because, yes, you can have different interpretation of reality, but there's also an objective reality. You can actually measure with clear, observable and measurable indicators who contributed the most. And it's interesting that over time, it simply vanished, reality, objective reality. And, you know, give it a few more decades and they probably think Tom Hanks saved Europe from the fascists. But in terms of the Hitler references, though, this is nothing new, of course. At least over the past 30 years, in every new war, the leader of the adversarial country is a new reincarnation of Hitler. So Milosevic was a Hitler, Saddam Hussein was a Hitler, Gaddafi is a Hitler, Putin, and some also refer to Xi as a Hitler. It's a silly way of referring to, well, simplifying the complexity of international relations and conflict. I mean, if you would explain, this is how you would explain politics to a child or a fanatic, which is, look, we're having a conflict because the other country has a very bad man ruling it. If we can just get rid of that bad man, we will go back to normalcy. You know, depriving an issue of all its complexity and dumbing it down, simplifying it to that extent is dangerous. And also I would put it in the category of propaganda. But again, this is often where we end up. It's narratives. This core propaganda. You want to reduce everything to a narrative of good versus evil, democracy versus authoritarianism. And it's dangerous as well, because the benefit, obviously, is it's good to mobilize the public if they think they're in a conflict with evil. The danger is if you convince the people that you're in a struggle of good versus evil, then you will reject a workable peace, because now, against evil, peace would require victory. And against evil, negotiations is appeasement. This was an observation more than a century ago by Walter Lippmann during the Russian Revolution, when he looked at the British propaganda. But you could as easily apply it today to the war in Ukraine, where more weapons is now the path to peace, and negotiations and diplomacy is an evil which we should not even discuss.
All right. Coming up next, the fall of 2024 may prove to be one of the most consequential seasons in modern times as Americans go to the polls to elect potentially a different president. But also, there will be shakeups in the European Parliament elections and a new face will lead NATO. We'll discuss it when we return with Professor Glenn Deason. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. Let's waste no time and hop right back in with our guest. Professor Glenn Deason, thank you so much for sticking back with us. Now, speaking of NATO, Joe Biden has reportedly endorsed the Dutch PM Mark Rutte as the next NATO Secretary General. Now, Jens Stoltenberg's term is coming to an end this fall in October, ahead of the U.S. presidential election. If Rutte has the backing of the U.S., is this basically a done deal? And what does that mean for the expansion of the Ukraine war?
Well, I think once Biden now, which was reported in Politico, has given his support for Rutte, I would consider that to be the only thing we need to know. I don't think the Europeans would go against Biden's selection. Of course, there will be this argument that there has to be consensus, everyone has to agree. But as we saw with NATO expansion to Sweden, countries like Turkey or Hungary who don't fall in line, the immense pressure come on them. So I don't think anyone seriously will oppose this. It wouldn't surprise me. It didn't surprise me. I actually wrote on Twitter more than a month ago predicting that exactly Rutte would become the next NATO Secretary General. Now, I don't have a crystal ball. I was merely reading the Dutch media. And in the Dutch media, they covered the future for Rutte. And they, he had to agree to step down as a prime minister of Netherlands, given some various scandals. And then the Dutch media reports how he was trying to get a new job for himself, that he was targeting this NATO top job. And in order to get it, he had made sure to, as the Dutch media said, sweep all criticism under the carpet, so effectively whitewash Israeli genocide. He's also taken on a fiercely anti-Russian posture and, of course, joining in on the bombing of Yemen. So this was kind of winning the approval and showing his loyalty to Washington, and then Washington will select him to lead the other Europeans. So this was already, I think, was quite predictable. That being said, I think it's 2/3 of the Europeans as well support his candidacy. So I think it's now a done deal.
I've heard some chatter of compulsory military service for EU states being discussed. That would de facto mean more soldiers for NATO. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron has thrown around the idea of this sort of independent EU-only military force or this alliance. Would compulsory military service be supported by most European civilians or, you know, this idea of an EU-only military alliance?
Well, in terms of the compulsory military service, it is becoming a concern because as Europe is now looking like the prospect of war is looking now more and more likely. I mean, initially, it was the Ukrainians who were supposed to fight, but now that we're running out of Ukrainians, it becomes a possibility that this war might be expanded. So Boris Johnson, he made a plea to the British where he effectively argued that they had become too fat and lazy, too disinterested in the army. So there is a push now to how to remobilize Europe. And to this end, I think it could be possible for some to at least warm up the public to the idea of compulsory military service, as most of the countries have gotten rid of it. This idea by Emmanuel Macron to develop an independent EU military force, it's been there for a while. The reason why they propose it is it has many reasons. One would be it's a reason for a further integration. And this is the problem because the EU can't really deliver much economic benefits anymore. So what's going to drive forward further integration? It's hard to make an economic argument for it now. So shifting to the military sphere would make more sense. I think also there's a desire for many Europeans to be able to assert some kind of independence. And keep in mind, the EU for years talked about strategic autonomy, European independence. But as we see now that the Europeans have become cut themselves off from Russia, increasingly China, they're becoming very dependent on the United States, which is causing a lot of concern. So, and the key instrument for the United States is convert security dependence into economic loyalty. So if we have military conflicts with other countries, we will more likely be able to reduce our diversification and become more reliant on the United States. So it has some purpose to build this EU army, but it doesn't have the likely. It's unlikely to succeed, I think, and it would also contribute to the current trend of making the EU less of a civilian force and more towards the so-called geopolitical or militarized structure.
Now, lastly, on the title of your new book, The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order, explain that title to us and perhaps your outlook for the conflict in the months to come.
Well, I argue that the Ukraine war represents something much larger than merely a proxy war in Europe, because you hear this rhetoric coming from both sides, on one side the Western countries and Russia talk about this as if it would be shaping the entire world order, and I think they do this because it's correct. We're currently part of the chaos we're in, and most conflicts today are to a large extent a product of a shifting world order. After the Cold War, we had a world order based on unipolarity. That means one center of power, which was the United States. And this is how the world was going to be organized, through US global primacy. Now, unipolarity is no longer reality in terms of the power distribution. You see now multipolarity has already emerged and is manifesting itself. But we're in the middle between two orders. We have left unipolarity, but multipolarity hasn't really cemented itself. And for this reason, the US would like to pull the world back to unipolarity, while Russia, China, India, or most of the world would seek, most of the world outside NATO, that is, would like to see the world push towards multipolarity. And I think this is a good way of understanding the Ukrainian war as well, why both sides are prepared now to risk even nuclear war. If NATO would win this war, Russia would be broken, and also that would weaken significantly China, and this would be what would strengthen the unipolar order. On the other hand, if Russia would succeed, then we would likely see multipolarity emerge. And this is also the message I get from people around the world. Various leaders around the world are saying, we don't necessarily support Russia's war against Ukraine, but if NATO defeats Russia, the world will really be unbearable. At least the West will be unbearable if they would then try to act as a collective hegemon again. So this is kind of the world order we're currently in. And of course, this also explains a lot of the conflicts with Iran, China, etc. Now, I argue that the new world we're coming towards is not just multipolar, but it's a Eurasian multipolarity. So different than what we had in the past, as these great powers from China, India, Russia are seeking to integrate the Eurasian continent in order to lay the foundations for the post-hegemonic order. In terms of the conflicts in the months to come, I think this is quite an important time for all of humanity in the months to come, because the way I see it on the battlefield, NATO and Ukraine is losing. It's just objective reality. It's a war of attrition. We've lost, Ukraine's lost its manpower. There's no more weaponry, the ammunition. Even NATO admitted we emptied our storage. And the Ukrainian army appears to be moving towards collapse, which is also fueling political conflict. So this is why we're in a dangerous point in time. Now, Ukraine might, if it collapses, what are we going to do? Are we going to send in, is NATO going to join the conflict and we're going to fight Russia, which would very likely end up in a nuclear exchange? Or are we going to try to find some kind of a peaceful settlement, or just watch Ukraine collapse? And there's so much dependent on this. Again, the future of the world order. So you should expect countries, the great powers, to be willing to take huge risks, even though it's difficult to predict the consequences. And again, this is why it's a extremely dangerous war, and the absence of any diplomacy and negotiations is so dangerous.
Glenn Diesen, professor of political science and history at the University of Oslo, thank you so much, as always. Go check out his new book called The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order. Thank you.
Thanks again for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.